Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guests today are David and Kristen Bousquet. They're the filmmaking team behind Redgate Films, a company that's done all kinds of advertising projects for companies like BMW, Nike, Samsung, and some others. And they've just put together their first short film. But it's not just any short film. It's the kind of story that gets so many of us excited about what the movies can do. It's a fantasy film, so there's wonder, magic, battles with forged weapons, a young boy searching for his destiny, and a creature. And this is a kind of creature that looks like it could be done by Stan Winston Company or Weta, the guys behind Lord of the Rings. It's got that kind of look, but it was done by Redgate Films. It was, in fact, their first attempt at doing a creature, just like it was their first short film, and they've knocked it out of the park. So we talk about what it took to put together such a polished short film, plus their advertising background, the clients they got, how they got to work with BMW and Nike and some of the others, and how that led them to develop as filmmakers and to get the opportunity to make a kind of high concept short film like The Lookouts. All that and more coming up in our interview with David and Kristen coming up next.
This is the N. Savvides podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. David and Kristen Bousquet, welcome to the N. Savvides podcast.
So thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I want to take a moment to say right off the bat, you all made a heck of a short film, The Lookouts, beautifully shot, a compelling story, and you all are doing so many challenging things, live creature effects, haze, shooting with kids. Let's set up your background a little bit. So some of the people listening, the young filmmakers, aren't drowning their sorrows in bourbon. They're like, come on, that's their first film? Seriously? So you all have also had quite a background in advertising, right? You all have done a number of spots together. So let's talk a little bit about that. From what I could tell, you all started off out of college. You did a spec video for BMW, and then it went from there. Is that about right?
Yeah. In college, we approached BMW down in BMW Design Works, who designed the Z4 to see if we can get some cars for filming a spot. And they totally backed us. They gave us a couple cars for filming. And that commercial really, I mean, I know, although it was a spec piece, it really helped kind of leapfrog our advertising careers after we graduated from film school. We started filming together in film school in 2002. And then when we graduated in 2004, we started our business right out of school, and that I think people were able to see what we were able to do with very little funds.
That was one of a handful of pieces that were all kind of mock commercials, and that format made a lot of sense for film school. In any level, people are looking to do narratives, documentaries, what have you. It's always nice to take on a smaller challenge, and in my opinion, you know, focus all your resources and all your time into delivering on a shorter 30 to 60 second length piece, as opposed to, you know, biting off a really high concept or even just a lengthier commitment and spreading your resources maybe thinner than they'll allow. So that was kind of the approach that we had during school, is creating sort of mock commercials as an exercise in trying to do different techniques and play with different formats and different forms of storytelling. And that was just a natural segue into actual advertising, because we kind of already been practicing in that world.
So you did the spec commercial for BMW. It seems like you all had a good relationship, because you all have went on to do several spots for them going forward, right? So talk a little bit about developing that relationship.
Yeah, that was great. Actually, the second piece that we did for them was more of a motion graphics piece, and it was for a branch there in Germany. But basically the idea was, and what kind of helped on this, to give a little more backstory, in the final couple of years that I was going to college along with Kristen, I worked at an investment bank here in San Francisco, and my job in the bank was on the presentation side of things. It was taking a lot of their merger and acquisition material and putting it into pitch books to pitch to companies to create these sort of high dollar mergers. And a lot of that formatting experience and a lot of that, you know, kind of the learning that came from being around, being in that environment and putting together these books and organizing them in such a way to sort of figure out that flow of information, we used a lot of that in our pitch material that we put together for BMW. So again, this is drawing on the resources that you have and the experience that you have. And so that's something that we used to sort of put together a slick little presentation for BMW. And they bought into it, or rather they were open to the idea, let us use the cars. And when the piece was finished, we had a presentation with them and showed it. And it went over well. I mean, I think the team that you know, offered up the vehicles and the design group there, some of the heads of the various departments that had a chance to see it, really enjoyed it. And even though that didn't segue into a direct relationship with DesignWorks, it did with some of the folks that saw it there on BMW's end over in Germany. And they reached out later on to see if we wanted to collaborate on another project. And that's kind of the way our whole career has gone. Ironically, we went for almost 8 or more years without even a website, because one job just sort of led to the next. And somebody moving from one marketing team, or rather advertising team, to another company. Just in this day and age, it seems like people spend about 2 to 4 years at a company and then they move on. So if you make a good relationship with somebody, invariably that's just going to bring in new business, because they'll most likely be moving on to another company and get you involved in projects there.
And I think that's key, is maintaining good relationships. You know, fortunately, we can kind of pick and choose who our crews are, and working with people that you enjoy being around is key. And also, if your clients, if you can maintain great relationships with them, then it makes it a win-win for everybody, and it makes the work that you do that much more enjoyable. So I think trying to have good relationships is pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, it fits right into what we're talking about with collaboration, because especially for us, being so dependent on the sort of word of mouth side of our own level of advertising, being that we're not, some of the tools that we create for other companies, we don't actually, or up to this point, haven't really used for ourselves, like websites and print material and surrounding collateral that would get your name out there. It really came from these relationships, and it came from people spreading the word, kind of, you know, because they enjoyed, there was a genuine enjoyment with that interaction, whatever the project may have been. We hope.
You all have gone on to work with other big brands like Cisco and Nike and some others. So what are some takeaways you have in working with these kinds of big brands?
Yeah, it stems back to this relationship angle, but sort of expanding the circle that you operate in. For us, a lot of the initial relationships we've had with you know, some of these larger brands have come via advertising agencies. And again, that, I hate to beat this drum again, but the idea that some of these earlier relationships we've had with individuals in advertising and marketing departments within one company, they may move on to a larger agency who has sort of a client roster of some more sort of familiar brands, some bigger money campaigns. And that's been really, that's been a real positive move on our end, working, even though we enjoy direct client interactions, working via an ad agency to sort of come in at a stage where the creative, the relationship is already set, but the creative is being ironed out. And that's a point where we like to step in. I think from a producing end, there's also some hurdles and some, you know, it's a different process to navigate those relationships, because the bigger the company is, the more cooks you have in that kitchen, and that does become a bit of a relationship juggling act. I know Kristen can speak to that.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes the best form of communication is the most direct line of communication. And that's just whether you're a direct client and there could be many channels that have to get clearance and approval in that way, or if you're working with an agency, it's always just trying to make sure if you're not talking directly with the client, what's the information that is pertinent, that's super critical and important to get back and forth between, because you don't want to have like play sort of like the game of telephone and make sure that right information isn't getting
right,
back
where it
and forth
gets through like 20 people's emails. Like, great, I'll be glad to forward this to them on Tuesday. We'll you know, touch base, and then they send it off to their people. Yeah. That could be frustrating, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is. Or it's like, I'll get back to you Thursday. It's like, no, we're filming on Wednesday.
right.
Yeah, it can get a little wild. And especially if, ironically, we just finished a project for a client where there was a lot of feedback after kind of everything had been captured. In fact, even after.
But we had 4 days. They approached us and said, you know, this is this massive piece that needs to be done at this partner summit, like 8 days from now. And there's a weekend in between. It was 4 days to come up with the concept and to execute production. And it's a high level concept, lots of locations and, you know, a huge crew. And it's sort of, you have to be producing it before the concept's even locked in. It makes it difficult when there's different channels of a company are trying to, like, you know, give their input and their feedback for what they think is key and a message. And I think sometimes that's the hardest, like for something so short of turnaround, is like trying to stay on point with what the message and the ultimate, this was for a show opener. So right. It wasn't necessarily selling a product. It was setting up a high level person's like what the speech they're going to be giving and, you know, just keying in what messaging is.
And on that note, and circling back to kind of the core of your question, which is, you know, somebody who's just getting into this game and might find themselves in these situations, what is some advice you can draw from this, aside from us just, you know, sharing our war stories here? I would recommend, you know, it's definitely something we're learning this every day also, especially on this recent project, but tackle a project with a believable scope, regardless of the scale of the company or the how much brand recognition maybe they already have publicly or how little, dependent on the amount of control that you're going to have. And like in the situation we're talking about now, we had an enormous amount of control, perceived control, and you want to retain as much of that as possible. And we were lucky enough to kind of see through the film all the way to the finish, but we set it up with realistic expectations at the beginning, and nothing will benefit you more than being realistic. I'm a huge proponent of always trying to push things to make them better, but there is a realistic limitation to how much you can push an initial concept prior to actually capturing it. Always, you know, through every phase of production, always keep trying to push it to be better. But if you're setting something up that's radically outside of your budget restrictions, radically outside of even the time that you may have, like in this case, we only had 4 days. We actually had, it was one of those unique situations where they opened up their wallets to the piece because they really needed it. And they're very open to, you know, just giving us resources that we had, but no amount of money can buy you extra time. And we set up an idea that, although ambitious, it could get made. And even though it was a challenge, we were able to make it. But it was having that awareness at the beginning. And I think being that Chris and I have worked together for so long, being that we're married, that it's a director producer collaboration, and we're constantly in communication, I have a sense of what can help make her life a little easier. And I know when I'm making her life difficult, and vice versa, she has the intuition to hear.
When are you making her life difficult? What is that? Not like, seriously, we got to go all over across the globe in 2 days. What are you doing to me?
Yeah.
Or it could be like, you know, I'm thinking the shoot's going to be one way, and he throws out some really expensive specialty piece of gear. Like, oh yeah, can we have this? And it's like, wait a second, that's going to blow half our production budget.
Right. No, I'm very much, I've been there. There's as much as we've worked together, I can be the guy who says, I was expecting 30 extras moving around in the background instead of 8, you know, that's something, just again, from a time standpoint, even if the money's there, the orchestrating that, can be an enormous hurdle. So she gets the occasional curveball, but she always makes contact.
All right. So there were a couple of your spots that I liked. I mean, they were all interesting. These three stood out. I was wondering if you'd be up for talking about one or two of them, and then we can go into the short film.
Certainly.
And specifically, it was the LucasArts one, the Nike Vision one, and the Boy Scouts one. So do you want to give us a quick little glimpse at what some of those involved?
Yeah, we'll trade off. I'll grab the LucasArts one just because that was like the passion project before a passion project, even though we did a number of years of just straight client work and not kind of pursuing our own story. When the Super 7 piece came along with some friends of ours, some of the earliest clients we've had there at Hybrid Design, they've got basically a vinyl toy branch called Super 7. And they hit us up with the idea that they're about to release this limited edition sort of 26 inch or whatever vinyl toy of a stormtrooper, and they needed a promo piece. This was just before Comic-Con, a handful of years ago. The idea was pretty open. I know the initial concept was, let's just reference to some degree these early sort of Machinder commercials back in the late 70s and early 80s. Let's get a taste of that kind of Hasbro styling and those early toys, especially the commercial spots that were coming out of Japan, and kind of design a retro spot that had that flavor. And since so much of that was like in-camera effects and these cheesy snap zooms.
I mean, cheesy is one way to say, I would say, pretty awesome.
It was absolutely near and dear to my heart, but in comparison to I think what a lot of people would just see that as sort of that retro flavor that you had during that era. But it was so much fun, and so much fun in kind of mimicking that style and adding that even the wear and tear on the look of the footage and the saturation levels and putting in the grit and whatnot. It was a blast doing all that stuff manually, the rocket fist, you know, actually putting little sparkler type things in the hand and holding strings to have it fly by. We had a blast. So that was,
And you got to play with a larger than life, or, you know, maybe not larger than life, but pretty large stormtrooper on wheel, so not everyone gets that on their resume.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that would be enough. It's like, all right, I got this. That then, like, all right, I'm sold.
Yeah,
that's
one of those days where you're like, is this? Am I actually working here? Or am I playing? It's a nice blur of the two.
Yeah. Then the Nike Vision piece, that was an interesting shoot. We did that shoot in conjunction with a still photo shoot for. Was it 1 or 2 days of shooting? It was one key day of shooting.
It was like one and a half.
And then a day of some pickup shots. But that was a fun shoot. It was a new season of eyewear coming out. And we hit several locations throughout San Francisco with the group of young models. And it was a challenge in the sense that we had to share and split time with still photographer, but it was one of those that it worked out both ways. I think we were.
Yeah, for the most part, we shared lighting and grip. We had two separate camera assisting teams, obviously, but we've got a pretty good relationship with the photographer we were working with. And it was kind of fun at each location. You know, one of those was on a rooftop, and then we were at the train station, and we would kind of build out our little set corner individually wherever we were going to hang a silk or shine some light. But even though we were trading off talent, we'd often trade off shooting spots. So I'd run over and film where Jeff was, and Jeff would come over and get some pickup shots wherever I had just left. And that makes that experience a lot more fun when it isn't this total division of roles, when you can actually collaborate with the other photographer on set. And also the fact that a lot of this was shot outside, so we weren't setting strobes. So I wasn't chewing up his footage with the wrong kind of light source, and he wasn't putting a bunch of flashes over ours. We could get a lot done in a short amount of time.
It was a really fast-paced kind of go location wise.
So Nike basically signs off on locations and the look and the clothing, I would imagine, and then you all say, great, let's play within these parameters.
Yeah. And a lot of, for that piece also, because it was moving fairly quickly, a lot of that level of back and forth was handled agency side. Mm-hmm. And then we came in for the final scout just to make sure it was possible, get our crew with some eyes on it just to make sure everything we needed was available, and then we went for it. But yeah, a lot of the stuff, even the pieces that happened really quickly, there's, you always have to count for sign off, because that's the world of advertising. Like, there's, it needs to go through a lot of checks and balances. And
there was definitely I don't believe there were storyboards for this, right?
This one didn't.
Yeah, it was too fluid. It was not knowing. I mean, the amount of time we're going to have at each location was really minimal. It came together really fast. And I think it's been one of the things, we'll know that we'll capture all the footage that we need. We just, it wasn't going to, the edit.
What had been signed off. Yeah. What had been signed off on was a lot of design material and look and feel pieces that heavily influenced, you know, kind of where we took the animation between scenes and all of that, the colored bar treatment.
The overlays,
The overlays and the colored bars were part of the language that they had established for that particular campaign. We just figured out a way to make them to move and have some sort of energy that helped the edit.
Yeah, because it did have to match the lookbook that I was created for.
Oftentimes, especially the stuff we've done for Nike and Samsung, it's part of an existing, either an existing campaign or a campaign that's launching in tandem. So we'll be the motion component of something that has print material, has still photos, and things are being used from pretty much any possible purpose, whether it's a web ad or part of the retail installations. And so we'll generally kind of adopt some of those graphical elements and either, you know, figure out a fun way to incorporate them via motion, because our job really is to translate everything into motion. And the way I see that is also a translation of these graphic elements. So anything we can do to give it a little extra flavor for the motion piece, I think generally benefits, and yet it's still visually kind of families with the whole campaign that is just about to launch.
I want to take a quick break from our conversation with David and Kristen to share a special message with you. This is usually the part of the show where I have some kind of advertisement or pitch. I'm not going to do that this time per se, just a special request. This has been a difficult couple of weeks for me. I won't get into the details, but some discouraging things. Some people have done things that have made me a little more cynical. I'm trying not to be that way. So all I'm asking, try to do something decent. Doesn't even have to be to me. Just be decent to others. Be courageous. Be considerate. Maybe I will notice. Maybe someone else will notice. And take heart and be inspired by that. Because there's a lot out there that's not so inspiring. It's a challenge to stay inspired when facing those things, to not let that turn us all a little more jaded. So let's try to do a little better, all right? Would be great if the listeners of the show start a trend and other people notice, like, hey, what's going on? Oh, well, they listen to the Encevides podcast. That's what's going on. Okay, something to aim for, right? Well, anyway, let's get back to our interview with David and Kristen. So let's talk a little bit about your short film now.
Sure.
I'm not going to ask you the budget, but I imagine percentage-wise, probably much higher than many shorts that get made. But it's interesting because it is kind of sort of like the advertising model. I mean, you are licensing property from Penny Arcade. They developed the initial comic upon which the story is based. And you're spending a reasonably high price tag to get it done. Where it seems like advertisers are more willing to do that these days than filmmakers. So I was wondering if that was ever something that you all thought about.
Well, the budget definitely came in higher than we originally wanted to spend. I mean, honestly, our goal was to, the quality was never a question, you know, whether we spend, you know, no money or the ultimate budget that we did spend, it had to be good quality and it had to be to our standards. And there's a level of, you know, a lot of the crew that was out there with us were just out there for the passion of it as well. And they worked with us for years and have heard us talking about it. And some have even pushed us to even try and get into the, you know, doing a narrative. But there was a lot of things that just cost money, that you have to spend. Like we had to house a crew of like 40 people and we had all the talent up in the woods and,
Really? So you built like a little like hostel or forest hotel?
Well,
out
there's
there?
There's a property out near the state parks that we were able to rent a large section of. I think we rented the majority of their cabins, and it was a way of keeping our whole crew out on location for a little over a week. Yeah. So, but like Kristen says, that has a sizable price tag to it, and it's not something you see on screen. You may not associate with that cost. We live in San Francisco. There's not a redwood forest directly near us. So yeah, we had to drive 3 hours and take our whole crew with us and put them up in the cost, which we were happy to do because, like Kristen said, these are enormously talented people. They gave us so much of their time and invested so much of their energy into the piece. It was a small price to pay, but you're still definitely paying a price. And it just, you know, it just adds up from there through the whole production. So to your point about approaching this like advertising, I would say yes and no, in that our advertising attitude of keep it short, keep the story tight and make it look as polished as possible rings true. But functionally, this is not an advertisement. If anything, it's maybe it's a showpiece, but we knew going in and we have that understanding even now is that we legally cannot do anything with this beyond putting it online. There's not a penny to be made off of
festivals
or film festivals. Yeah. We can't make any money off of it and we can't turn it into a feature. And we knew that going in. So it absolutely had to exist on its own as a standalone film. It's not a trailer for a larger piece. It is a short film, and we wanted to play with the way that we told that story in more of a with more of a feature length sequencing than a linear story of a short film. But the intention was never to turn a buck off of it or even try and figure out a way to make it pay for itself because we knew it couldn't. We just didn't own the IP. But it's done a lot from just a. Or rather, the hope is for it to continue to be an exposure piece and
just people just to enjoy it.
Something that people enjoy, absolutely.
I think, you know, one of the other highlights of it was to be able to play with things and tools that we don't get to do in our advertising world. I mean, ultimately, the client is going to have final say in what your creative is when you're working on an, you know, a commercial or store installation or anything like that. But what was great for this is like, we had never worked with a drone before. Okay, well, let's put our Epic on a drone and fly it around and get some cool shots. That was fun. We got to do it. You know, the Phantom 4K Flex camera had just been released and was still in its beta mode. But we got to use that for a fight scene and some of the ambush scene. And that was a lot of fun. And just new tools, devices that we were able to incorporate. And I don't feel like they feel forced. We were able to incorporate, you know,
To
fit into the story and to play. And all that said, it gives us experience so that we can take this knowledge that we've learned from this and apply it with more confidence in some of the commercials that we can pitch or in those ideas. And I mean, David and I, mostly David, ended up making the creature, the you know, it was a 40-pound wearable puppet suit for our creature for the film. And that was not really intentional. I know that he's super happy that it ended up that way. But, you know, we hired that out and it was not acceptable. And so we're looking at each other like, oh my God, what do we do now? And because we got some really high quotes and at that point our budget was tapped and we couldn't afford it. So David just was like, well, I'm going to make it. And I was like, oh man. So that means I'm doing this too.
Yeah. She knows the subtext of that commitment.
I wanted to clarify, I didn't mean it as an advertising piece in a diminutive way. I mean, it was just an interesting model, a different sensibility, but it did feel like a standalone piece. And it felt very cinematic. So please don't be angry at me. Like, you've insulted our masterpiece by calling it an advertise. No, no.
You haven't at all. And I wasn't saying that as a as a clarification. No, it is that because we did take some liberties with the sequencing, and to be perfectly honest, the final montage of visuals, although it's functional and it services that emotional change that Penn has when he belts out that final cry and that's the launch into the charge, it has this real movie trailer vibe to it. Like, people are used to seeing a rapid series of images and a music swell and an impact leading into a title sequence. I mean, that's just familiar to us. We've seen trailers do it before. And I've been a little surprised to see how quickly that has been a point of write-off for the film as being potentially misconstrued as a trailer. But I fully acknowledge that we use that sort of mechanism intentionally and had the film kind of have its swell into a title at the end so that we would leave people with these questions in their head in the same way that a trailer does. And obviously the function of the trailer is to imply that there's going to be a bigger piece. So that's the only clarification I was making.
Fair enough. So Kristen was talking a little bit about the creature. We'll touch on that here. I read that after you all wrote the script, one of the first people you reached out to was a concept artist. Why did you choose to bring in a concept artist in early on? And also, why did you choose to hire someone as opposed to trying to do some of the concept stuff yourselves?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a great question. Concept art is one of those things that we often don't have time for. Generally, we'll have time to storyboard out, to pull together mood images, sometimes even create a little mood piece that matches the tone of the film that we're about to have. But we really haven't had the time, and more often than not, haven't really had the need to explore ideas being developed via concept art. And I love concept art. I love illustration. I love the work that's being done. I mean, all the way back to Ralph McQuarrie with the Star Wars series and every, you know, pretty much every of my favorite films in between, just digging through the concept art and seeing what people have done to flush out ideas. We wanted to have that experience. And so this film, because it was so visual, because it was set in a fantasy environment, I wanted to collaborate with some talent just on the concepting side of this thing. And there was plenty of drawings. I did plenty of drawings, and I know Chris and I sat through plenty of brainstorming sessions, sketching things out. But I really wanted to see what other talent out there could do by just being given this idea and how they would interpret it. And it was kind of nice that Penny Arcade already has a large audience and Lookouts has a sense of a visual style that when you're asking some other talent out there to see how they would adapt this into motion visuals and how they would turn this into live action, it was a great experience. And I'm really happy with some of the pieces that came out. And they wound up in our little creative book as well, our making of book.
Yeah, and I think the fun thing about the concept art is it's just to kind of also help get your own like creative juices flowing and help a visual idea. You know, the guys at Whale Shark, they did the basilisk, and the final basilisk doesn't look like it, but it definitely stemmed from mm-hmm. their initial design. And I know David, when we first started talking about it, he's like, oh, you know, these daggers that we're going to have in this film. He wanted something really cool, but at the time he couldn't think of just off the top of his head. It's like, I don't know what it wanted to look like though. And so we did take two very specific designs from multiple that Whale Shark did, and that they, you know, they sent some really cool options over, and it was fun to see what they had, and they polished out two that David picked early on. And I think also we started like January 2nd from the script, from writing the script and location scouting, everything. Like, we started all that so quickly, the pre-production, that we had the concept art kind of going along at the same time. So it was one way to also give a little bit of division of labor and free up some of the brain power that David needed to kind of wrap up the script.
To be clear, you all said it took about 2 years to make it. You were doing this entirely or working on other projects alongside of it?
We weren't doing it entirely just this. We did take off the first few months from like January, I think maybe up through production. We started, I think, did the first big part of production up in May a couple years ago. But we really wanted to get the pre-production done. We had to take work on after our first amount of shooting. Just, you know, we're not made of money.
The thing is like bleeding money here. Come on, we got to get something coming in.
Yeah, at a point you got to wake up to reality and be like, all right, let's get out of the sandbox and let's do a little work, and then we can go back to playing.
So yeah, we took on a few jobs, and then we finished up production, and then it was like, then I guess it kind of came to, we were just waiting on the creature. So we did take about 6 months off fully just to make that creature. Yeah. And that was tons and tons of just research. All this.
That was definitely full time.
David was doing the Stan Winston School of Visual Effects online tutorials.
But before we get too heavily into the creature, just another final thought on the concept art is a bonus that concept art had beyond just getting our own kind of footing in what the visual language for this film would be. We use that concept art we sent it out with the scripts that during casting, we had a visual package that we were able to show some of the talent that were some of our selects and a number of our crew, same idea. It all feeds off of, you know, going back to that pitch book we made for BMW, we sort of did the same thing with this concept because we don't have a history and narrative storytelling, and there really wasn't anything to show for what we wanted to make. So we created our own lookbooks in the same way we would approach a client, and we generated a lot of interest, not just from you know, our friends, but other crew members that we hadn't worked with.
And that's like a lot of people were kind of on the fence of working on the film. Once we sent them that with the script, I was like, oh yeah, no problem. I'll work on this.
Right. They have something concrete that they could say, oh, I see what you're going for. This has personality. This could be fun.
Yeah. And I also think like there was initial thought put into, I mean, we had some really good quality, some of those full page layout concept arts, like the paintings were beautiful. Really, and I think it was branded from the very get go, like with a professional looking pitch book that we had. And I think it's like one of those things when people have passion projects, they could range from A to Z. And I know that people with their working lives have to be really careful with how many passion projects that they attach themselves to. And I think, you know, it was just trying to balance that with taking on paying jobs. But it looked from the get-go that we were going to put money and put effort, and it was going to be something hopefully worthwhile for them to be a part of. And so that was probably one of the biggest payoffs of the concept art.
Yeah, showing that there's definitely going to be some time and attention because it's already being put into the film. If you get a taste of the production value that's going to come out at the finishing line of this thing, if you can give that early, it definitely excites people in the right way.
Well, you all mentioned the creature a couple times, so let's talk about it. This is the basilisk, the big signature creature in your film. You order it from another company, and it comes, and you've been clear a couple times that it was quite a disappointment what the other company gave you all. And that's clearly a collaboration that didn't go well. So what are some things that if you had gone back in time, you could have put the feelers out? What might have improved that situation, you think?
I want to hear Kristen's response for this also. But honestly, Nick, this specific example is one of those things where I think the learning lesson here is to just persevere, because we had done every bit of cross-checking and anticipation that you could do to whatever foresight I might have going back. There's very little I probably would have done if we could turn back the clock. I think we probably would have pursued the same company. All the signs were right. They were well vetted in terms of what we needed. And just things don't always work out. Things, you know, we didn't see eye to eye on what the final piece would look like. And
I think it also goes to the point of, I mean, whenever you are paying somebody and you're hiring a professional, there's a line between giving them space to do their job and trust with that they're going to do it right. You know, this was not the only bad experience. The first aerial team that we hired, the same thing. I was going to
ask you about that as well. Man, you guys are really eager to talk about this.
We've talked about like, what can we pull from this lesson? What can we learn?
Yeah, what's the lesson to be learned?
And I was like, you know, we had our camera assistant with us. We had met for hours and talked through everything. And so anyways, sometimes you give people the benefit of the doubt to make room to do what they need to do. And it just doesn't always work out. But for those two bad experiences we had multiple amazing experiences. So I don't want to just dwell on, you know.
No, of course not.
Sure. But I think that feeds into the idea of, for every one of those scenarios, I mean, Chris and I more often than not overplan than underplan. And there was plenty of reference and graphics. And for all these situations, this was in no situation was there just a team going off and kind of being left to their own devices and just on a whim coming up with something. There was plenty of check-in and there's plenty of reference and a lot of material to work from. And it just didn't result in a piece that we wanted. And that just happens. I don't think there's not always a way that you can foresee that and you can work around it. The thing to pull away from this is it would have been easy to sort of quit on the creature then, or it would have been, I'm not going to say easy to just accept what we had and try and make it work.
Are you sure we need to show the creature?
Yeah.
It becomes a whole new concept piece. Like when they talk about the basilisk, it's like that elusive mystery in our lives that we don't see. It's a metaphor. That's what it always was. Yeah.
There you go. It would have shortened production time, that's for sure. But we took the hard way out and decided, you know, the most difficult path is going to be the most rewarding, and let's just figure out how to make this thing. And I'm, you know, it's easy to have look back with rose colored glasses, but I couldn't be happier with that outcome and what we were able to make out of it. Because it was all a first-time effort.
The creature looks fantastic. And so I would not have guessed that it was your first time making creatures in that scope, right? So, be honest, you haven't done any other kind of creature work, even briefly. This was the first time.
Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, we made a...
That's not a creature.
That doesn't count. All right. Yeah. Wow.
Not even close. Actually, I would take it a step further where making the creature is, you know, it's like making a film. It's 100 different roles. It's 100 different activities. And once they're all finished, then the actual film is finished. Well, the creature, every step of the thing, you know, from the clay sculpting, even just learning, you know, how to soften clay using a little toaster oven and that whole process and pack it on and glazing the foam mold that's under the clay so that it retains its form. Like every single one of those steps was a first time step for us.
Learning how to make fiberglass holes and
You know, our bed is still full of fiberglass from the fiberglass runs. But it was a host of challenges. And when you put at the top of it, not just that we needed to have a creature, but it needed to be light enough that one person can operate. It needed to be big enough so that when we were setting it, you know, up against these epic redwoods, there wasn't this complete disproportionate scale going on, that the thing actually had some mass. And especially with the debris and the fog, you had to be at that sort of 1/4 scale. The articulation of it. Once the thing got moving, that it couldn't just be this rigid, like the one that we purchased. It was an incredibly rigid, and its surfaces, whether the skin had some movement to it or the beak, it was all kind of made out of one material. So in this one, it was very important to us that whatever was bone felt hard, you know, whatever was fleshy had movement to it and shape to it, and then just apply that anatomy to the whole form. And hopefully the thing will give you some, you know, some dynamic movement when it's shaking around on camera.
And you also had most of the creature effects were done in camera. I mean, except for the ending shot, is that right?
Anytime that you see it flying.
Yeah.
So like there's one where it's lifting off the ground, like off the behind the log. That's the body.
What we built was basically the collarbone to the neck to the head. So it's sort of the upper torso.
And one wing.
So anytime you see more than the upper torso, you're seeing you're seeing either kind of CG extensions or a full CG creature. And there were a handful of wides, not a lot. We tried to keep those as short as possible, but you needed that. Because we had a cut of it where it just played in puppet shots, it just played in mediums and closes, and it really missed that sort of spatial scale juxtaposition where Penn's smaller kind of fleeing out of the forest and you see this large shadowy object in the background. You needed to have that combined with the close-ups. But my feeling has always been the closer you get to an object, the more real I want it to be. I want it to react to light and I want it to move like something in the physical world. And so that had to be the puppet. We let the extra wides and the wides be CG. They worked.
So it sounds like you all could have another career doing, you know, Stan Winston creatures if you're ever so inclined, because it was a gorgeous creature. You all spent 6 months in your garage working on it together at times, right? Did you ever have moments where you all looked at each other and you're like, yep, this is why we got married, sweetie, you know, like happy mid anniversary or whatnot?
I know David loved making this creature.
Not always. There was, I mean, 6 months battling with anything there. It had more lows than it had highs, but the highs were really high. But I'll let you finish that thought because I think you have more to say.
Oh, well. I mean, looking back, I'm more proud of the basilisk that we made it and proud of what we made. It's not something I want to do again. I know David would happily jump in and make another creature, but man, it's a lot of chemicals. And I know I'm trying to be that weird thing, but you're breathing in some nasty stuff, even when you're trying not to. And
Wearing the gas mask around, and the neighbors are peering out. Like, what are they doing? They got a little like meth lab going, or what?
Right? Yeah. The neighbors thought we had the meth. No, we built a 4-foot oven in our garage, and not to get too. David could wear the gas mask. I can't wear those because I'm allergic to the latex around the front. So I'm like in there just holding my breath.
Yeah. We should keep her out of there during the bakes. But I would say it was definitely times where we were saying, thank God we're married, because two people would never survive through this process if they weren't. And then also I was secretly hoping, I hope we stay married.
Because
it was definitely a challenge.
Has the basilisk made it into your little Story of Us album or what?
Right.
You show the family, like, here's our significant, here's a 2-year anniversary, 5 years, and oh, look at this guy, so cute, right?
Right. I think
he may end up on the Christmas card this year.
Yeah, I think he's going to appear on the Christmas card.
There you go. See? You got to take advantage of all your resources. That's good.
Yeah. Definitely. For the family now.
All right. So let's talk about your relationship in the way that it plays out on set. David, you are director and DP, which sounds crazy of itself for a project like this. And then Kristen, you're producing. So how do you all balance the different roles?
Well, you know, when we first started working together, like David said early on, that we were kind of both going on to the photography route, but David's a super talented photographer. And when I was like, you know, I think we might have a future together. It's like, he's so much better. So I picked up producing that I think had like a natural kind of interest and talent for. But I think.
Well, also your eye. Sorry. Adding on to that is that she has such an awareness of what is going to be needed because she's a photographer herself, that when you apply just the understanding of what she can do in the edit room and how she sees a piece coming together from a photographer standpoint, that just makes her a very a producer on a different level, because there's that sense of anticipation. It's kind of like an athlete. It's less about their skill set and more about their game awareness and anticipation. And if those are at a high level, it makes their own skill set just appear that much better, right? Because they're foreseeing every move. And that's what I love working with Kristen. It's like, she has that foresight. She just knows what to expect.
Oh.
What on set dynamic you're talking about?
to go off of that, doing directing and director of photography, I mean, those are both intensive jobs, both involve trying to balance a lot of things in your mind. So I was wondering if you'd elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, for sure.
When we get to have our main gaffer, I think it's all about surrounding yourself with great people, right? So we have a gaffer that, I mean, he and David are always seem to be pretty much on the same wavelength. And, you know, having first a camera assistants and operators and stuff that you work really well with, helping that.
Yeah. In any situation where, I mean, the trick of being director of photography and director, just speaking for myself separately, is you have to be in tandem watching performance, but also what's going on in the frame at the same time. Like that, I don't even know if it's ideally. Classically, we'll say people want to have a division of that attention, so that somebody's just focusing on performance and somebody's just focusing on the composition and the frame and making sure things are looking nice. For me, there's such a marriage between the two. I feel like visually, if something's really falling apart, it will affect performance, at least when things are cut together. And again, this is drawing in our experience as editors. Just to add another dynamic to all of this, Chris and I both began as editors. So that's kind of our base. It's thinking about a project, about how it'll play out in a sequence. I talk about this a lot, but it's because to me, it's the most important. It's the story is told in a sequence, and how you, the way in which you approach a project, the way in which you approach storytelling is figuring out how to translate that static medium, that print on a page, into motion. That's filmmaking, is that translation. And so much of that comes down to the edit. And if your mindset going into a project is as an editor, it informs everything you're going to do. It certainly informs how you're going to shoot, what kind of coverage you're going to get. And it certainly informs how you're going to have your talent perform it, because you're already stitching this piece together in your own head. And I feel like when it comes to Lookouts, I mean, I had watched that film in my head for 2 years before anyone got a chance to really watch it. So what I'm doing out there on set is I'm just trying to get everyone else an opportunity to see this thing that seems very clear behind my own eyeballs. And that's maybe why I tend to feel most at home being the director of photography in addition to the director, because it's that relationship between the two, making sure the frame is lit and moving in the right way so that the performance actually reads the right way, because only those combined can work when they work in a sequence and when they're cut together. That was a long answer. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's good. That goes along with something else that I wanted to address with you. It seems like you're someone who wants to stay pretty consistent to what the storyboard sequence is, to get it more or less exact on the storyboard and then just execute that when you go to shoot. Is that pretty much how it played out on the shoot of the Lookouts?
As much as we could, yeah. We definitely boarded the piece out to have a specific flow, and there's an economics to that also, because you don't want to shoot in excess. We didn't have that kind of time. I mean, I definitely admire the Hitchcocks of the world who, or at least relate to that approach, because it is a way of doing a first pass visual translation of an idea, even in static form. We've talked about how just adapting a comic book innately, in that it's a sequence of images, I think people draw too much of a relationship between storyboards and comics, just in that they all play in panels. That's obviously a similarity, but the way in which you move through those panels is kind of how, a film operates as well. And I think that's a fair comparison to make. And so, yeah, for Lookout specifically, to answer your question, we tried to stick to the storyboards, and we tried to iron those out as much as possible. Everything fluctuates in the moment, obviously, but the edit stayed pretty true at times. Certainly certain scenes, it's funny how looking at how the edit pulled together and then going back to the boards, I'm just self-analyzing, going, man, I was jumping all over the 180 and this conversation's flip-flopping, just finding all the mistakes that actually were made in boarding it out and how we were able to fix those on set was, you know, it's nice to have a place to begin just visually so you're not kind of grasping.
I had one technical question for you. We don't do a whole lot of technical discussion, but one I was curious about, you all were shooting with the Phantom Flex sometimes out in the forest and, you know, lighting was probably inconsistent, at least from the environment. What sort of additional lighting setup did you all use to get some of those 1,000 frames a second slow motion?
Yeah, some pretty big lamps. I mean, I think our biggest was around roughly a 10K. I think we had an M90 out there, which in its housing has a little more punch than if we had a full-on 10K. We used some
HMI
closer. Yeah, they're all HMI based. We used some closer Joker lamps that have a pretty hot output, all pushing through diffusion. You kind of have to match that dappled light that was coming through the trees. But every scene, every exterior, we were adding light to and doing a level of flagging and masking of where the light wasn't supposed to be spilling in from, just like you said, just from a match movement and a you know, kind of matching the sun angle. But that's very true. Like when it comes to high speed photography, you need a lot of light, even adding to what the sun was giving us. We had to pump in some pretty big lamps and run our generator almost throughout the entire shoot. I mean, just talk about the trucks and the gear that we had to haul out. Fortunately, that riverbed location was relatively close to where we were staying. So in terms of big company move, it wasn't like it was 15, 20 minutes down the road, but you're still hauling all that gear out there. And we were actually hauling it across a creek for the most part. So that there,
electricity and water.
Yeah, those don't play well together. So that's when your crew really, really steps up. And we had some amazing, the Little Giant lighting and grip killed themselves on this job. The whole team that came out there were running really long hours. They're always wrapping up equipment very late at night, just with their headlamps and no complaints, just rock stars. You know, make sure they got a full glass of bourbon when they get into the cabin.
Is that what happens? It's like wake up and go to sleep. Here you go.
Oh my gosh.
You don't need coffee. Okay. There's bourbon here, sir.
Well, we could have thought, like, oh, after, you know, 14, 16 hour shoot days, because, you know, when we're on set for clients, we try and keep it at 10 hour days. This last week, we just went into a 12 hour day. But gosh, on our film shoot, it was like 14 to 16 hour days. So we thought people would just want to go back and crash. Nope. Start up the campfire and just open the bourbon and the wine and the beer. And it was just party all night. And then wake up and do it again. I was like, man.
There you go. That's a loyal crew.
You had to admire them, and we tried to partake as often as we could. Sadly, Chris and I were always stealing away and messing with the wardrobe all night or prepping for the next day. So the last 2 days we got to hang out with the rest of our crew and enjoy the time. But they the minute we wrapped and everyone was back to the cabins, that's where the night party began, and then the day party would start just a couple hours later. Rinse and repeat.
It sounds like many of your crew members were, great team players. Although one person in particular, it sounds like, was not. I got to ask you about this. The guy who crashed your camera, the drone operator that you said was it completely demolished after that? And how do y'all recover from the camera crashing?
Well, it didn't ruin it. We just had to send it in for servicing. Basically, on the bottom of the camera, there's and I guess crash is a little.
Oh, it crashed.
It crashed.
It just didn't crash and burn.
It did. Yeah. Crash. It was like a lot of dust and dirt also. So there's fans and vents on the bottom of the camera that are just sucking in tons of air to cool off the inside. So it just managed to suck in a ton of dirt and dust, but we just sent it. We had a couple of cameras. We had the Phantom and we had a couple of Epics. And so we just used the other one for the rest of the shoot and then sent ours down in for servicing, and it was fine. We got it back and all is well. But, you know, I'm going to pull a positive out of that experience is good riddance to that guy. But boy, did we meet an amazing aerial team that was brought up out of LA that actually successfully did our opening shot of our film and Wild Rabbit team. And
all the shots, every aerial that's in the film was done by Wild Rabbit.
And I mean, they made it look easy. That's how good they were. And it was, so I have to say, you know, when we have a commercial production or anytime we need, it's like, I recommend them and they'd be the first people I would call. They were a stellar team.
Did you feel like you handled the crashing of the camera in a graceful way, or was like, you know, a traumatic event that you shudder at kind of thing?
No, I mean, David and I mean, it sucks, right? But I think the you know, you asked about how we operate on our sets, and we like really low stress sets in a way. Like, we don't yell, we're not the screamers or anything like that. It's like, we try to make them as laid back. And I think for some people, maybe they're too laid back in a way. Nobody wants to be around people that are yelling and screaming at everybody or losing their heads. I don't think it helps the work environment, or everybody's, you know, got the goal to try and make the best thing they can. Whenever he thought he was done and the camera was on the ground, it was like, all right, well, goodbye. You know, I mean, it was, he,
yeah, there, it ended.
I mean, I wasn't hugging him when he left. Yeah. I was gonna do that way. I was just like,
yeah, it was the end of a professional relationship. It never got ugly. I think it's odd in this industry how, I mean, you've got the screamers in any line of business, but it's strange how often we hear from other crew of like, there's just venomous producers and directors and people in that top tier trifecta just barking orders down the chain. I don't think it has any place on a set, and we certainly regulate our behavior when it comes to when things aren't going well. You dialing up the tension and starting to bark at people just doesn't do anything for a production. So yeah, I feel like we got out, we let him go as gracefully as one could let a guy go who just totally wrecked a day.
Well, that's good though. That's encouraging that you all try to still handle those situations with dignity. So you all went on and found an effects company in Argentina, I believe. Talk a little bit about the collaborative process with them.
Yeah, that was special in that it was a team that they were just about to sort of fracture and go their own ways. It was kind of the end of the business, the effects business that they had put together. They had just finished a new feature, and enough members were sort of splitting off onto separate projects. They're kind of dissolving the team that they had.
And not in a negative way.
Not in a negative way. Just in everyone kind of going their separate paths, but they were using this film as sort of their last hurrah, a passion project for them. And that was really fortuitous because it was just finding another team that saw the love in the concept. It wasn't just a paid gig. And, just another one in the line of projects that they had to knock out that day. This was going to be the last one that they did specifically together. And they did a great job. There was a split up of the type of, we sort of categorized the shots, whether they were kind of matte painting type pieces where we were adding detail to elements in the frame, kind of punching up that 10 to 15% sort of textural detail. We did that to a number of the passes of the statues. They built out the cinder leaf shots, which was a big sort of important element that we had in there. In a handful of cases, we just sort of had some picture cleanup, nothing really major. And then the bigger sort of visual effect shots, some of the creature stuff was split between that team and then the final shot. And also one of the wides of the creature. It was after the root attack where Penn runs off from the safety of the tree root and you see the creature flying up in the background.
So those, one of the creature shots, we actually kind of parsed that out amongst people.
Yeah, they were after the Argentinian team had done kind of sort of first round pass of those shots. We actually sort of redeveloped them and had some separate animators and texturing artists just independently. So it began as the Argentinian team, and then we sort of built together our own team, kind of a motley crew spread all over the map to finalize these last couple shots. And even we had a pretty strong influence on the set extension of the final shot before it then went on to our compositor, who really did an amazing job. And he made it look the way it does. I mean, he's the one who had it married to the visuals.
To be clear, you all did some of the set extensions as well and then sent it off?
David created the set extension for the last shot. Yeah.
Yeah. So the environment build out is a mixture of location photos. Chris and I went up to back to Mendocino together, and we took a bunch of reference photos of the trees in that area and the ground covering. And then
modeled some of the trees.
Yeah. The main tree elements, especially the bent over, kind of bent to the side tree that the creature flies over, and all the brush and all the foliage kind of hanging around there is all built out as 3D geometry. And then our compositor took all of that into Nuke and then painted on additional textures, additional kind of fine line branches and all that kind of high frequency detail that you see in the sort of the sculpts and the geometry there in the background. He added to all of that in the compositing process and really married the whole thing together.
I think the post on this was definitely a worldwide effort or collaboration, but you know, I think it's interesting that nobody's asked us, why did we go outside of San Francisco or California even for a post? And, you know, we searched high and low I thought we had a pretty good visual effects budget, but, apparently we did not.
Well, also there were a lot of shows.
It was wrapping up at that time. Extremely busy right now.
Yeah, even the effects houses that really had an interest in the project, it would have been too far downstream in their scheduling process, or they just flat out just didn't have the time for it. Like it was one of those unfortunate situations where even though we had relationships on the visual effects end of things, and this project was like a perfect opportunity to collaborate with some of these people we love working with commercially, people were just too busy. It just didn't work out. We had to find all new teams, and there was definitely some struggle in there. And there's something to be said for as beautiful as it is that we have this amazing level of interconnectivity and the ability to communicate with people all over the map and have them all collaborate on a project. That I take nothing away from that, but the end of this also really instilled the importance of working with local talent and working with people that you can sit with, because there's huge advantages and very real disadvantages on both sides of that coin. We got a taste of both, so it was good.
Yeah.
You all mentioned in the making of booklet that a lot of the crew came in. You didn't know them as well. And then when they left as family. So I was wondering if you had any moments on set that you want to share where you all just got to bond together with some of them, maybe at the campfires, drinking bourbon and whatnot, or just other moments that come to mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think, a lot of the keys we've known, they've been like family, but let's say like in a lot of the Griffin Electric team, they were kind of actually, this is their first jobs ever, to be on set, not just working in the grip house. And a lot of personalities come out late at night.
Yeah. But also during the shooting, since even though we had a decent sized team, everyone is still doing multiple jobs. Mm-hmm. And when all levels of a production have that attitude, it really warms up the set environment. One beautiful thing about this production is how few egos there are out there. And I don't think a project like this could get off the ground if you had people coming to set saying, you know, this is my single defined role and I don't step outside of it. And if people need help, I'm not going to contribute to that. I mean, when people are watching, you know, Kristen, the producer, hunched over the fog machine, waving, you know, atmosphere in the background, it becomes really obvious that like we're all chipping in and we're all going to make this thing happen, and that there isn't this like huge separation in terms of titles on the set. It's that we're all filmmakers and we're all collaborating on this. And even for the people that we hadn't worked with before, it's easy to find a common ground when you all see each other as filmmakers and not as titles, basically. You know, you got to respect the hierarchy, but also be aware that, you know, people are doing this just out of the love of it. And that's shared.
Kristen, anything to add to that?
Oh, I was just thinking about some of our sleeping environments out there. It involved lots of mice that kept people up.
That's one way to bond when you all huddle together, trying to ward off the evil spiders and whatnot.
Shared hardships were as real as the shared love of filmmaking. So I think she can speak to the shared hardships also.
Oh, just Karen Sorum, who was our scenic out here, she brought her tent because there's like this really pretty stream. And remember, she was like, yeah, I'm going to sleep out here by the tent. We're like, you know, there are bears out here. And she's like, that's okay. I guess there was a really big spider in her cabin and she'd rather risk getting eaten by the bear than the spider in the cabin. I don't know. It's just people brought out like their ukuleles and the guitars at night. I mean,
that was fun.
Yeah. Just.
Yeah. It's like camp, like stories by the campfire.
It was.
It became a little bit. Yeah. It became a little bit of a summer camp for big kids there at a moment. And that was fun too.
We even had marshmallow roasting contest.
There you go. Doesn't get more camp than that.
I know, right?
Yeah.
All right. Last question for you all. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you all?
Client-wise, or even in hopefully more of these narrative projects in the future, I know a lot of the work that we've been happiest with, and usually that's stuff that generates other work and gets eyes on other projects, are when we're brought in early. I mean, when we're involved on the creative side of the project and earlier phase, just because eventually this is going to all be translated into some sort of motion project, and you need people who see what an idea involves even while it's being pitched and while it's being formulated. And Kristen, again, has that foresight, and I'm always trying to push things into how they'll be executed, not just thinking about things from kind of a creative exploration standpoint, but really thinking about, all right, this idea is out there, but how is it actually getting done? I think if there's anything I would want to communicate to a future collaborator, it's that's the mental state we bring to pretty much every phase of a project, is always thinking about how it's actually going to get done and trying to make it kind of as creative as we can. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I was going to say, I still think probably one of the biggest and most important things is communication, is having open communication, being clear about communication. So many assumptions can be made, and I think so much time, energy, and money gets wasted on assumptions. And so I think when everybody can be on the same page, and it all happens with communication, whether it's through open dialogue, storyboards, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. That's just one really, what I think, to achieve any kind of great concept is through good communication.
David and Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. People want to learn more about your short film or some of the things you do. Where would they go?
The film has its dedicated website, lookoutsshortfilm.com. On there's a link to the film. There's the making of book. And it's also on Vimeo, and you can search Vimeo, just Vimeo Lookouts. And that as well, I believe, links to back to the website and some other information on there. But I think the lookoutsshortfilm.com is a really great starting place.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, best of wishes to you all as you make your festival run here. I'm sure you all will get all kinds of additional accolades. So great talking to you, and looking forward to those Christmas cards with the basilisk on it.
Awesome. Fantastic. Thanks again, Nick.
Well, all right. And have a great rest of the day, Nick.
Yeah, bye, all guys.
Right. Bye.
So that's my interview with David and Kristen Bousquet. Now, I just want to share a few related thoughts about the discussion and some things that connect. Collaboration is a difficult thing. Doesn't always work out. Sometimes you think you're on the same page and you get a monster that is not quite what was discussed, as David and Kristen faced. But it can also be something really special as well, where you work together in friendship, mutual respect and admiration to produce something special. And it seems like that's the kind of collaboration that David and Kristen are fortunate enough to have. Not the kind of thing that happens often. This is a show about collaboration, and we've had people who do collaborate with their partner, but this was the first time that we had a husband and wife on talking about their work together. So kind of neat, right? Something else that was pretty neat to encounter was the honesty that David and Kristen brought to the conversation, specifically being able to acknowledge certain parts of their filmmaking experience where things didn't quite work out as planned. They didn't do it in a malicious way, but they acknowledge it wasn't always smooth sailing. Sometimes you don't get that. Sometimes people just say, oh man, it was great. Beginning to end, everybody was so nice. They were geniuses. All so kind, beautiful, beautiful. Okay. That kind of thing is disingenuous at best, but it happens so often in the entertainment world, it seems, because everyone or so many people are concerned about putting the best spin on things and not saying anything to agitate and whatnot. And that can actually cause some problems. So it's appreciated when people come along who don't do that typical thing. Now, going back to my comments about advertising, I want to expand on that because I actually think about advertising a little differently than some people. I tend to see it in a much more favorable light than some cultural critics might. I mean, there is the chance that advertising can inflame desire or get you to buy things that you don't need. There is that dark side of it, just like in anything. But at its best, it can help people find things that improve the quality of their lives, goods or services that are legitimately useful. You have an iPhone or whatever smartphone you're using, the GPS on it, pretty robust. I mean, now you don't have to stop and ask for directions. That's kind of nice. We learn about these things through advertising. And a lot of times these advertising campaigns are really enjoyable to watch. The Coca-Cola polar bear campaign is one that comes to mind, really heartwarming. But think about how many advertisements are enjoyable enough or amusing enough that people want to share them. In contrast, you have some of the films that you might see at a film festival. Now, I enjoy going to film festivals as much as the next cinema enthusiast. Many things I see there I enjoy quite a bit. But then there is that aspect of it. Sometimes the artsy ones, the important ones, are kind of depressing. I suspect that some of these film festival segments get selected based on how depressing they are. Now, there's probably not an official scale where the evaluators are asked to rate the film based on how likely they were to kill themselves after seeing it, but it seems like it's there at least in the back of their minds. So, sort of like an implied understanding between everyone, like, oh, yes, of course, we want it to be thoroughly. All right, I'm kidding a little bit, but only a little bit. I attended a film festival a couple of weeks ago, and some interesting things I saw at the festival, but there was a particular festival segment that I found rather disturbing. And I was talking to the festival programmer about it, saying pretty much something along those lines. And he acknowledged what I said, and he took it as a compliment, as if, yes, thank you for acknowledging the hard work we did to make something really disturbing and twisted for you. Right? Like, well, I don't mean to brag, but we have a special liaison who gets these things, these films, directly from hell. We had to do a lot of heated negotiations to get these things, all right? Well, anyway, that's generally not the feeling I get when I watch advertising, unless if it's a really sleazy product. But that's not the typical thing that you see in mainstream advertisements. Well, some of it's a bit much. Some of it's a little too sexualized, taking things too far. All right. But my point is that not all advertisements are of themselves bad and worthy of suspicion. Sometimes, yes, but sometimes it can be a valuable thing, maybe better than a lot of the critics will acknowledge. So, yeah, for me, comparing something to an advertisement is not an insult. But anyway, Lookouts is a great short film, not an advertisement. Really enjoyable. We'll put a link on the page. So I would encourage you to check it out. No cost to watch. You can watch it. It's about 10, 15 minutes, and you'll get something quite enchanting out of it. You know, something I didn't get a chance to bring up to David and Kristen, but something I want to mention here, there's a part of the film that reminds me a little bit of the film 300. You have someone, a mentor, leader, figure, who's by a fire trying to encourage someone else, a young man, to take action, to follow his destiny and man up, so to speak, and do what needs to be done along the lines of what you have in 300. I'm not sure if it was a direct reference or just a coincidence, but it just happened to remind me of that. And it is something worth mentioning in the context of collaboration. It seems like our society is in great need of that. People in leadership positions urging those in their society to rise up to better things and doing that with respect and even affection. Without that, I'm not sure that a number of us will become the people we have the potential to be. Now, it can go the other way. You could have someone, some prominent figure who demoralizes. Like I was talking about earlier, about some of the things going on, about needing to see inspiration because I see so much of the other side of what's not inspiring. And it can have that effect. You could have people who are there who are, instead of calling people to rise up, aim higher, be better, who don't do that, who are not a role model, who discourage, and the opposite might occur, right? So it's worth thinking about that when we say, hey, let's talk about collaboration. There's also that aspect of how collaboration can call something up and say, hey, aim for something better. And you know what? You could say that a short film like The Lookouts does that for us. We look at it and say, wow, look at the quality and effort they put into this. You heard they spent over 2 years of their lives trying to bring this to life. Not something they're selling. They're making it freely available to us to check out. And possibly some of us will see it and say, yes, that is excellent. And not just congratulations to them, but let me honor that and do likewise. Let me take what I'm doing and strive to get to that next level because of that encouragement, because of that collaboration. So not a bad thing for us to think about doing for others in our own way. All right? That's our show. What are your thoughts? If you get to check out the film, it would be great to hear your take on it. You can leave a comment or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncevides.com. If you like the show, would you consider going on iTunes and leaving a review, something positive, help get the word out, or just share it with a friend, share some feedback with me. Any of that is appreciated. Music for the show provided by Rob Coslo. It's the song True Gemini. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.
What is